Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're not feeling too crowded in this room. We had about, I don't know, it's about 480 people on Monday to this session, and they thought, oh, it'd be a good idea to show it again. So did anyone come on the Monday session? You were locked out? Oh, right, okay, so it really was that crowded. Okay, so well, welcome to this session. Just to give you a little bit of background on myself, I work out of the UK as a consultant and pretty much work around the world these days, working with sort of fairly major oil companies, banks, governments, and so on. And my speciality is really infrastructure and infrastructure security. I absolutely adore networking, so I get involved in some sort of IPv6. I did a DA, Direct Access Precon on Sunday to go through that. But I've worked with Active Directory right since its very, very early days. And in fact, I used to design real-time control systems and write the operating systems for those. Those were a long time, that was a long time ago. And our first management system was Windows NT. We'd rejected I won't tell you which version of Windows I started with, but we rejected previous versions of Windows as not being good enough. Windows NT came along, and we started using it as a management front end for our very high-speed real-time control systems. And then I got a call one day from, I'd started working with a product group then. I got a call one day from Microsoft UK, and I thought, yeah, what are they, have I breached an MD, an agreement, a non-disclosure agreement I've got with them? And they said, we hear you know something about Active Directory. And I said, yes. And they said, could you come and skill us up? And this was my, I put the phone down and thought, what? Microsoft asking me to come and tell them about Active Directory. And I did. That's how I formed my relationship in the very, very early days of Windows 2000. So this was during sort of probably between alpha and beta. And then I've got more and more involved in AD ever since. And I even got invited out to Redmond to do an AD internals session for all of their guys out in Redmond, which was very interesting indeed. So what I want to cover today is what's new in 2012. It's not 2012 R2, this is 2012 itself. There's a couple of very nice features in the GUI for doing things that probably should have been done a long time ago. The ability to manage the recycle bin, for instance, the fine-grained password policy capability. DC Promo has been completely revamped. So when you come to install and upgrade to Server 2012 and Server 2012 AD, one of the things you're not going to have to think about is where do you run AD prep? And I'll come back to that in a moment. There's also, how many of you run DCs on virtual machines? Okay, so that's probably about half of you here. There's been a lot of work done on making DCs now virtualization safe, and I'll go into the details of that. Also, the ability to clone DCs. So you can take one DC and you can create a clone of it and then deploy that multiple times, which gives you a very, very fast deployment of domain controllers. Claims-based identity has been included in Kerberos now, and also the ability to better handle constrained delegation. Do any of you use constrained delegation at all? No for Kerberos? Okay, well, I'm just going to that very, very briefly. And also the ability to manage access to files and folders using this now dynamic access control, which ties in with the Kerberos changes as well. Protecting the RID pool, a little bit of work done on that, and I'll go into a little bit of detail on that. PowerShell for absolutely everything. So how many of you use PowerShell today? Okay, that's about 50% of you, maybe a little bit more. Everyone should be using PowerShell. If you're not using PowerShell now, get to know it, start to use it. Really efficient ways of doing absolutely everything: management, deployment, troubleshooting, and so on. And there's a few more features, and I'll go into a little bit of detail on some of the additional features as well. But first of all, what I want to do is just set the scene. You may have heard of this week of the Windows Azure Active Directory. So you've got the Active Directory and you've got the Windows Azure Active Directory. So how do the two fit together? Well, Active Directory has become an umbrella name. And under that, you have Windows Active Directory, which is the Active Directory you know and love. You host it, could be on-premise, could be in the cloud. You manage it, you manage the data. So you're managing the infrastructure and the data. Services you've got there are directory services, which of course is your identity store. You've got the authentication services, which go with that, which is NTLM, Kerberos. And then you've got Active Directory lightweight services, certificate services, rights management services, and so on. And that stream of services will continue to expand. Then you've got Windows Azure Active Directory. And what that is, it's an Active Directory. Well, actually, Active Directory is a bad name. It's an identity store, which is hosted by Microsoft in the cloud. They look after it completely. You don't even have to think about the infrastructure. And so all you do is you manage your data. And why do you have identity of users stored up there? So you can authenticate them against things. And how do you authenticate? You don't use Kerberos, you don't use NTLM, you use the federated identity protocols, such as SAML, WS Federation, OAuth, and so on. And they're gradually adding to that list. And these are industry standard protocols for authenticating over the web. The great thing about using the Windows Azure Active Directory is that you can have an application that is absolutely anywhere. And how does it get authenticated? Well, the user hits the application and then gets redirected to go and do the authentication. So the app could be in the cloud, it could be on-premise, it could be in a partner organization. And what we can get is the app to redirect the user up to the Windows Azure Active Directory, and they can authenticate there. Although another component of this is the Access Control Service, and what the Access Control Service does is it brokers identities with lots of different identity stores, including Facebook, LiveID, Yahoo, and so on. So if you're thinking about applications for the future, think about maybe you should be looking at federated identity, and a possible component of that is the Windows Azure Active Directory. You'll have also heard about running your AD in the Azure cloud, and that we need to think about running in a virtual machine environment. So I just wanted to make absolutely certain that we got the clarification there, because I didn't like the name Active Directory for the Windows Azure Active Directory, because it's not the Active Directory we know that we domain join and we do Kerberos authentication against and so on. The other thing you can do is you can synchronize your data into the Windows Azure Active Directory. How many of you got an Office 365 account? Okay, so for those, I think I couldn't, so the lights are a bit bright in my face, but I think it was just one hand that went up. You already have a Windows Azure Active Directory. You are a tenant of the Windows Azure Active Directory. It is the same directory. Okay, what I want to do is just give you a quick demo of the GUI changes that have happened in AD. But actually, what might be useful is just to quickly show you. Why don't I show you this very quickly? What I'll do is I'll come back to that. I just wanted to very quickly show you how the federation works. Let's leave the network to wake up for a second. If we go into the management tools, and I'm going to use the Active Directory Administrative Center here. In terms of GUI enhancements, we've got the capability of enabling the recycle bin and also managing password policies. But notice down here, there's a whole raft of things we can do with dynamic access control. Haven't got time today to go into dynamic access control. Thank you very much. Seeing if anybody was awake, congratulations, sir. You are the only person awake. Oh, you were waving as well. Sorry, I wasn't awake enough to see you, so I was asleep as well. The Active Directory Administrative Center, down the bottom, I've got the dynamic access control. And I'm going to tell you what it does, but we don't have time to go into the details of that. But let's go into our environment here, into our AD structure, and notice there's no deleted objects container. Well, how do we get it? We just simply come over here, we enable the recycle bin. And having done that, we can do a refresh, and now what we've got are deleted objects or a container for them. Inside, there's nothing there at the moment. I have an OU structure where I have demo A, I have demo B, and I have some users in demo A, and I have some users in demo B. I've actually turned off object protection to make it easy to delete demo A. So it's just giving me a warning, and demo A has now gone completely. It is in the deleted objects container with all the users that were in there as well. And I can choose one of my users. Let's take Harry. Harry happened to be in demo B, which was below demo the demo A OU. Let's restore Harry. And it tells me I can't do it because Harry's parent is not there. So what I can do is I can locate parent, restore. Again, we get an error message because the demo B OU was underneath demo A. I can locate parent, restore. Demo A is back. Let's choose demo B, restore. Let's grab them all, and we can then restore. And of course, they come back with all their linked attributes, group membership, and so on. The other item which is now being added into the UI is the ability to set up password policies. And we go down here, we've got a password settings container. How many of you use password policies, apart from the overall domain policy, how many of you use password policies elsewhere? Three hands going up. These are becoming more and more important. A lot of companies now see their Active Directory as a sort of multi-tenanted environment for different tenants in their organization. So they're supplying a service now, which is an identity service and so on, to different parts of their organization. And different parts of the organization can actually have requirements for different password settings. And by doing this, you can actually set that up. So we can just simply go new, password settings, and let's choose a suitable name. What should we call it? Nasty. And you'll see why in 1 second. Okay, so password policy length of 200 characters. And we don't like Harry, so we'll apply it to Harry. Do a check name on there. And that's now applied to Harry. There is this precedent setting which we need to set. And password policies actually get applied to users, to groups, all right, not to OUs. So we can have a group containing users and apply a password policy there, or we can apply a password policy directly on the user themselves. All right? If you apply it directly on the user, that has higher precedence than if you apply it to the group. But what happens if you have two password policies applied to a group or two password policies applied to a user? You need a tiebreaker, and that's where the precedence number comes in. Anyone know whether the lower number wins or the higher number? It's one or the other. You've got a 50-50 chance of getting it right. Well done, sir. Yeah, you're a gambler. It's the lower value happens to win. And if you have two with exactly the same precedence, we need a tiebreaker in the directory. Anyone know what the tiebreaker in the directory would be? It's used quite often as a tie-breaking thing in replication and all sorts of other bits and pieces. What is absolutely unique within the directory? Well, no, time is not necessarily unique because we could actually do a batch generation of objects and they could actually have the same time. But the GUID, yes. So, no, it doesn't actually matter. It's you haven't got a clue because you do not know which would be lower or higher. So you can decide that one of them wins, but you don't know which one. What the directory needs is an immutable way of actually saying, this guy wins, all right? So, in terms of setting this up, as far as you're concerned, it's random, Right, so you couldn't sort of rely on the GUID tiebreaker. So we've done that. We've added Harry. Well, okay that. And then next job is we can go and look at Harry, and whereas we haven't, let's just do a refresh on there. So we get our deleted objects, or not our deleted objects, the objects we undeleted. Demo B, there's Harry. And another really useful thing here is result and password. So we can see Harry's got the nasty password policy against him. And if we choose another user, Peter, and look at the resultant password policy, we see here that there is no fine-grained password policy. It's taking whatever's set up for the domain. Now, the other thing is, if you're not too familiar with PowerShell yet, this is extremely useful. If we look down the bottom and bring this arrow up here, what it's done, it's recorded every single operation I've just done. And I could, for instance, grab that and just copy it. And let's just, not into Notepad, I want to do it into here. Do a clear screen on there. Pop it in there. And what I've got is the PowerShell command for that particular operation that I did within the AD. So it's a great way of working out how to do things in the AD. The other thing I just wanted to very, very quickly show you is, and hopefully this is warmed up by now. Yes, it has. And you didn't see this screen, by the way. It says Bing. Can you read it? And luckily, I'm not a Microsoft full-time employee, so I can use Google if I want to. It's a free country. So if we do, what have I got? Yes, xts-cloudapps.net. This happens to be SharePoint that I've just hit their SharePoint server. It says you're not authenticated, and it's bounced me off to the access control service in Windows Azure. And it's saying, how would you like to authenticate? Oh, I'd like to use a Live ID. Bounces me off to Live ID. Oh, I'd like to use a Google ID. Bounces me off to Google. Or should do. All right. And well, we'd use a Azure ID, and it will bounce me off to Windows Azure Active Directory. Let's just try the Google again. It should bounce me off to Google. It was bouncing me off to Google. I'm going to leave that cooking, and by the time it's, I don't know why it's being a little bit slow. Oh, I know why. I'm already authenticated into Google. So what it's done, it's actually, I'm already logged into Google. So it's bounced off to Google, said you're already logged in, and there we got access to SharePoint, and you've got john@xtseminars.com.co.uk is actually a Google identity that I use. That was just, I thought it might just help sort of clarify this idea of federated authentication. To do that, you use the Windows Azure Active Directory. And the good thing is, when someone says to you, we run Active Directory, you can now say to them, is that WAD or is it WAD? As in Windows Active Directory or Windows Azure Active Directory. And they'll look at you as though you're completely balmy. Okay, PowerShell, it's gotta be your new best friend. Yes, question. Yes, so the question is, can you use this to enable the recycle bin password policy setting object if you've got 2008 R2? And the answer is absolutely yes. So there's no change to the underlying. All it's done is given you the UI. It's just a reminder, as PowerShell should be your new best friend. And does anyone go to the PowerShell 4 sessions this week? Okay, so PowerShell, it's absolute commitment to PowerShell. Everything's built on top of PowerShell. And the nice thing about the Active Directory Administrator Center, it now exposes it. If you want to use that, in the AD Administrator Center, what you can do is you can put a start and a stop, all right? And start is, it just marks your start point for all the recording of the information, and then the stop point marks the stop point. So you can grab a block of PowerShell for a whole series of operations you've done. Okay, in terms of installing domain controllers, if you try and run DC Promo, it gives you that little message saying, you don't use DC Promo anymore, so DC Promo has passed away, and may it rest in peace. They have completely revamped DC Promo. It is a lot more solid, and it does a lot more error checking along the way. So we start off, first of all, it's sort of how do we get the Active Directory, the AD directory services in. It's add roles and features, which you're probably familiar with from the sort of 2008 R2 days. From there, we end up at this screen. Check out export configuration settings. There's lots of places now where we can export ways of doing things. So there's an XML file that we can pull and allow us to help automate adding roles, etc. Can be run remotely. So I can actually have, I could put a 2012 server in and load up all of my different servers into that 2012 server. And if I've got another 2012 server, I can just right-click it and say, you know, install roles. So I can manage it all through one place. Having gone on from there, you will find there is a post-deployment message, and it says promote this domain server to being a domain controller. And we start the process, and you're probably very familiar with this, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail in terms of individual screens. I'll point out the new highlights, so sort of standard stuff of, you know, adding to an existing domain, etc. And you can do that. You can bring a server 2012 into an existing domain. If you're going to do that, you must, your domain must be at server 2003 functionality level, or sorry, the forest must be at 2003 functionality level or higher. So that is the minimum requirement in which to bring in a server 2012 domain controller. You've got the ability, you know, there was sort of advanced mode previously in DC Promo. There is no advanced mode now. It's all exposed for you through these single steps. So we can actually go in and choose if it's a DNS server, et cetera, standard stuff, but now in the standard way of doing it, we can choose where we're going to actually put our domain controller in, and we can choose the site. Obviously, it will choose it by IP and suggest this to you, all right? However, if you're deploying into another environment, we'll have, for instance, we're deploying into the Windows Azure virtual machine environment. We don't set IP addresses on our machines. They're dynamically assigned. So what we'll have to do is configure our sites based on that information. Next thing is, you know, this little message, I can't set your delegation record for you in DNS. Well, now what we can do is we can specify credentials to actually write the record into DNS. So if the person doing the DC promo doesn't have the right permission, we can specify the permissions here. Next job is where we're going to replicate from, and also, do we want to install from media? Have any of you done an install from media? Okay, so just a few hands. When you did it, was it a big database that you were coming from? Not particularly. Okay, because one of the things they've done, install from media, what we do is we use NTDS util to create the install from media seed. And basically, the install from media seed is a copy of your Active Directory. All right, and when you do an install from media, you have that copy of the AD, and you put it, you make it available at the time of doing the promotion, and it takes the information from there rather than replicating it across the network. Now, one of the things NTDS util used to do, it used to insist on doing an offline defrag. So having taken this copy, it would do an offline defrag. So what's the difference between an offline defrag and an online defrag of Active Directory? Active Directory does an online defrag on a very, very regular basis. But what would an offline defrag do for you that an online doesn't? Sorry? It reduces the file size. So online, all right, what it's doing is just saying, oh, look, that object's been deleted, that's gone, What I can do is I can clean up the pages within the directory. So the online just does that. It does not reduce the file size, where an offline defrag crunches the file size. And it can take, on a big database, absolutely hours to do. So here you are in a rush to do a DC promo. You go and make an IFM installed from MediaSeed, and suddenly you're sitting there for hours and hours waiting for this offline defrag to happen. Well, you can decide, I don't care, I've got big disks, I don't care how big the file is, then, and just choose in NCDS util not to do that defrag. So on we go, and then we choose where our log files are going to go, where sysfold's going to go, and the database. Next job is to install domain controller. The wizard needs to perform the following operations: a forest and a sysprep. So this is our AD prep, okay, which you're probably familiar with. You've probably done it at some point. AD prep, we do a schema prep or forest prep, and we do a domain prep. Where do you do the forest prep? What domain controller do you do it on? When you run AD forest prep? Schema master. Well, yeah, and that sort of makes sense, because when you do a forest prep, you're changing the schema. What about the domain prep? Where do you run that? Anyone remember? I think you said it. Infrastructure master. Why the infrastructure master? No, well, there's actually no logic to it. There's no need to run it on the infrastructure master. What Microsoft wanted to do is they just wanted to run it on one DC. So it couldn't run on more than one. You only have one infrastructure master, so they chose that one. It could have been run on the RID master. It could have been run on the domain naming master, but they just simply chose that you run it on that. You don't even have to think about that anymore. AD Prep now will just sort it all out for you. And what it will do is it will work out where the FSMO, the master roles are held, the flexible single master operation roles, and automatically do this, the forest prep on the schema master, and the domain prep, it just chooses where it does it, and it knows where it's doing it. So now you can have it done automatically here, or you can choose to do it prior to actually deploying your domain controller. What's happened with this one is we've started to bring the domain controller into a 2003 forest functional level domain, and what it's saying is you need to prepare the forest and the domain. You need to be an enterprise administrator to be able to do the forest prep. If you don't like the person doing the install to be an enterprise administrator, then just run AD prep on its own. But again, you don't have to worry about where you run it. It'll just run and do the thing properly. So next job is it gives you a review of your selections, and then what it will do is give you the option of getting the PowerShell. And then it goes through and thinks about everything, does all the prereq checks and so on. But the great thing about it is it's been doing prereq checks all the way through. So it doesn't get to this stage. It warns you as you're going through if there's a problem and you need to sort something out. So all the way through that check's done, and finally we get the final check. DC virtualization. DC virtualization has always been a little bit of an issue. And, you know, you've got a DC, and on that DC, it's running from a virtual hard disk. And then the DC fails, and you say, oh, don't worry, I've got a snapshot of that virtual hard disk. I'll do a restore. Is that a good idea? It's a very nasty idea. Because what actually happens, just to give you a little bit of background on this, what we have is there's two DCs. And this is a very simplified model, but you can think of the database on a DC as having a name, and that name is the invocation ID GUID, all right? And I've just said the one on the left is, its invocation ID is E, so that's the name of the database on that one, and the name of the database on the other one is M. And what the DC does is it keeps a vector, which is called the high watermark vector, which says, I've had everything up to USN 3000 from database M. It's not actually from a DC, it's from database M. Right? And it keeps these vectors for every single database within the domain or the forest, depending on which naming context we're coming from. Now, every time you change an attribute, the USN goes up on the particular DC. So the highest committed USN is specific to a DC. So now we've got a vector. This guy on the left says, I've had everything from M up to 3,000. The guy on the right says, I've had everything from E up to 1,000. So if you look at the USN on the one on the left, it's 1,000. You look on the right, there's 3,000. So they're both totally up to date. So at that point, you snapshot, and then time moves on, and you end up with things being added, everything, and USNs bouncing up. Again, looking at that, we can see that the one on the left is fully up to date because it's got a vector which has the same US or same numeric value as the highest committed USN on the right. Same with the left. Things carry on, and then this guy crashes. And you say, no problem, I'll restore from snapshot. Okay? So now what we have is this guy on the left saying, from the M database, I've had everything up to 5, 6, 7, 9. And the guy on the left says, I've had everything up to 1,000 from the E database. So what's going to happen next? Replication is going to work in one direction. Which direction is it going to work in? So will the one on the right get updated, or will the one on the left get updated? What do you think will happen? Let's look at the next slide. That's the situation. Oh, we'll make it worse. We'll add some more users on that side. So now the highest committed is the gone there. So it says, send me your changes from 1,000, because he's saying, I've got everything up to 1,000, so send me all your changes. No problem, here they come. We've got all the changes, everything works absolutely beautifully. All right? This guy says, send me your changes from 5, 6, 7, 9. And he looks, he said, well, I haven't got any, because I'm only at 3,050, so there aren't any. And that created a real problem. And what would happen is the guy on the right, if you add more and more and more and more things to him, right, more and more changes to his attributes, suddenly he'll start replicating again as soon as he goes over 5, 6, 7, 9 as a USN value. So you ended up with this chunk of data that wasn't replicated. It was known as a USN bubble. It's absolutely got to be avoided because it gets really nasty. And it gets worse. You can end up with SID reuse and all sorts of things going on. So in 2003 SP1, Microsoft introduced quarantining. So send me your changes from 5, 6, 7, 9. There aren't any. That's a bit weird, he says to himself, the domain controller. So that's obviously not right. So what he does is he writes an event log message. He then disables inbound and outbound replication, so he can't cause any problem. And then what he did, he shut down the net log on service. So basically, the DC sort of slit its throat, really, and said, I'm not a DC anymore. And then you had to sort of basically get rid of that DC and rebuild. Now what's happened is in Server 2012, and this relies on the appropriate hypervisor, the hypervisor can have a thing called a VM generation ID. And what the VM generation ID does is it is exposed through to the operating system through the BIOS APCI namespace. So it means the operating system can pick this number up. And what happens on a domain controller, on DC Promo, it takes this number and it stores it into the Active Directory. And it stores it into the Active Directory in an attribute of the domain controller called MSDS generation ID. So now, constantly, what will happen is the MSDS generation ID stored in the Active Directory is compared with the hypervisor generation ID. If you deploy a snapshot, if you put in a copy of a VM, right, what happens is that generation ID changes. And immediately it's spotted. And as soon as it's spotted, the DC says, hey, I've gone back in time. Something's not right. So what I'll do is I will go into an AD restore mode. And it says, I'll accept that what's in my database is okay, not corrupt. But what I'll do is I will change the invocation ID GUID on this. So if anyone's got a vector on me, it's now useless. So I've got a new name for the database. It discards the RID pool, because if it's dropped down back in time, what we don't want it to do is start reusing RIDs that it used previously. The RID is the back end of the SID. If it reused, let's say we generated a user with a RID of 1,000, and then we'd gone up to 1,000 or 2,000, and then we went back in time, our RID pool could be sitting at 1,000 again. So we could create another new user with the same RID. So it invalidates the RID pool, and then it says, well, hang on a minute, sysfol, I'm now non-authoritative for sysfol. So what it will do is it now waits to replicate sysfol in again. So everything is completely happy, and this gives you this capability. But what you need is you need to run it on a hypervisor that will actually support the VM generation ID. And there's all of the Server 2012, Windows 8 hypervisors, and so on, all support this. And there's now support coming in the VM space as well, VM Workstation 9. And basically, watch that space. So if you're using different hypervisors and you want to make your domain controllers safe in terms of virtualization, then you need the appropriate hypervisor. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just give you a very quick demo of that. My thing's just locked itself in the... It doesn't like my thumbprint anymore. What I'm going to do is I'm going to work on DC2 here. So I've got just two DCs in my environment. Thank you. And working on DC2, and I'm going to, on DC2, first of all, have a look at the event log. And if we look at the event log, and what you can see is an event 2168. And if we look at event 2168, what it says is the DC is currently running on a supported hypervisor, and the current generation ID is this number. So I'm just going to copy that and put that into Notepad on here. So we've got a number in there. And then the next event that's in the event log, let's just close it off so we can actually see that one. It's a 2172. And what it's saying is the MSDS generation attribute value is the same. So that value is the same. So as far as it's concerned, everything's happy. The value in the Active Directory is the same as the one from the hypervisor. So it's happy, and it'll just carry on. All right, it doesn't think anything strange has happened. So if we actually create a user, let me show you in the hypervisor first. So this is held in the hypervisor down here under, this is my, oh, sorry, I want to do two. And if we go into virtual machines and go away, sorry, I meant to switch that off. Exit. Before someone says something they shouldn't. If we go down here, and this is the XML that controls the hypervisor, and if I just do a find on that, we got gen, and there it is. So that's the GUID. Let's put that down there. Let's bring this back over here. And where's my copy of Notepad? and then switch back to this one. And as you can see, this number here matches that number down there. Yes? Nope. It's not obvious, is it? Okay. This concerned me first of all. I thought, how on earth, if you ever need to troubleshoot, how are you gonna see that number and that number are the same, or a portion of that number? That number, it actually exposes two 32-bit numbers through the ACPI BIOS up to the operating system. So that's 64 bits, two 32 bits. That number down the bottom is 128 bits. And that number on the top there is the bottom 64 bits of the value in the hypervisor. And it worried me for ages how this works. I had to figure it out. So what you can do is, if you need to check this, the best thing to do is to use, if we use LDP, LDP has a very nice feature in it that I use all the time. And just copy that. And if we use utilities, it has a large integer converter. It takes a 64-bit number, and it splits it into two 32-bit numbers. All right? If I take the top half of that, and if I pop that into calculator as a programming mode, and paste that in there, convert it to hex, and copy it. It actually, there's a leading zero that it doesn't show on there. Take the lower bit there, and go back to decimal, edit, paste, and convert it to hex, edit, copy, and put that in there. And let's just go back to that. Can you see that number there? This bit here is the same as that bit there. It's the lower 64 bits of the GUID. So if you ever need to relate the two, because for some reason something's happening in the hyper, you know, something's happening to keep pushing your AD, are those numbers correct? And the other trick, which is well worth mentioning to you, is if you're doing a demo and you've got more than one DC, if it's one DC, it doesn't matter if the hypervisor value changes because we're not interested. But if you've got a demo environment and you've got multiple DCs, right, and you snapshot them, shut them down, revert them, and bring them back up again because you want to do more testing, they'll all come up. AD will start replicating okay, but sysvol is dead because everyone is sitting there saying, I'm non-authoritative. Right. So what I do is, before I start a virtual machine, I literally rewrite that GUID. So if you go back into the folder which I have, so what I do is I've got the generation ID GUID stored, and having reverted to snapshot, I just write that into the XML file. Right? And it means my DC comes up without the generation ID GUID having changed. And that's actually quite a useful little tip if you are going to be demoing or running multiple DCs. Okay, let's create a user. I want to create a security principle on this machine. And we'll just create this guy. In fact, what I'll do is I will create a group because it's a lot quicker. So into my AD, let's create a group. New group. Where are we? Group, and we'll just call it one. Okay, a group is a security principle. What I want to do is show you the SID. So at this point, I'm going to do a snapshot. So we're doing a snapshot, and we'll call this one demo. So I've now created a snapshot. I'm going to create another new user, and the new user will call, sorry, not another user, another group. And we'll call this two. Okay, and now what I'm going to do is, having done that, I'm just going to check that these guys have replicated to DC one. So let's just check that. We'll do a refresh. There's one. Two's not come over yet. And there's two. So one and two have replicated. Let's go back over to DC2 and let's revert. At that point, what's going to happen is we've now gone back in time. So two's vanished for the moment. Okay. And let's look in the event logs now. And what we'll see is if I do a refresh on here is we will have a 2170 event. And if we look at that, it says the generation ID change has been detected. So immediately we've discovered that this thing has reverted. It's a snapshot. Generation ID GUID has changed. And if we look up here, it says the transaction was aborted. And then it says, can you see that okay? I mean, it's quite small. Can you see that okay from the back, or do you want me to zoom it? You're right at the back? Zoom it. Okay. So what it's saying is here, it's going to create a new invocation ID, so it'll be seen as a new data. It's going to validate the RID pool. And what it's going to do is going to request a new RID pool as well. So it goes through that process. And then if we look at a 2185 event up here somewhere, higher. Ah, thank you. I was looking for it. And 2185, it's basically, this is all about sysvol needing to be sorted out. So it's doing a non-authoritative restore of sysvol. And then 2187 is where everything is back and fully operational again. So pretty quickly, it sorts itself out. And if we now create another user, so not a user, but another group. So I'm going to create a new group. And I'm going to call this 3. And let's actually refresh on this. We should find 2 is replicated in quite happily. Let's use LDP again. And let's connect. I want to just check the server's not been set. Bind on there. So this actually authenticates me using LDP. And let's do this. Let's set the fonts up to 16 point. And if we go into view tree, and I'm looking into my directory here, what I can see is we can see 1. And you can see 1. This is the object SID. The back end of that is 1607. Okay. So what will the value of the, this is the relative ID. What will the value of the relative ID be on 2? What do you think it'll be? So what happens when you create a new security principle? It just bounces the up by 1, okay? So if we look on 2, and it's 1608, but now, what do you think it's gonna be on 3? Roughly. Will it be 1609? We invalidated the RID pool, didn't we? So it's going to jump by how many? How big's the RID pool? Anyone know? The default size of the RID pool is 500. So what we'll find, it is somewhere between 250 and 500 bigger. And if we look at 3, they are 2102. So it's actually gone through this process of bumping up the RID pool size. So the other thing, just to show you, if we go back to DC1, what we can see is, actually, let's just go back to, before we go back to DC1, let's go back into the event log. And if we look at the 1109 event, what it's got is its invocation ID attribute. Let's just pick that up. Oh, invocation, that's it. Just put that into Notepad, drop that in there. And the invocation ID, attribute, the old value is there and the new value is there. So we can just remember it's 42 and AF is the new value. If you go over to DC1, there's two reasons I want to just do this, is just to show you that there's a whole raft of new AD replication things. So if I just do a get AD rep and just tab through there, so we can get the attribute metadata, the connections, the replication failures, partners, queue operations, sites, links, bridges, subnets, and this is the up-to-dateness vector table. Remember, the vectors were being held. And I'm just doing it on ADDC1. And what we've got is actually got a vector on itself. It's got a vector on the new. Do you remember the new one, which was, let's just go back over to the new one in here, was AF2168 is the new one. So it's got a vector on the new one, and it's got the vector on the old one, which is the A2. So we've got multiple, sorry, just go back over that. So we can see that it's actually holding these vectors. As far as it's concerned, it doesn't know the other database has vanished. All right? All it knows is it's got a new database to replicate from. Okay, if we do DC cloning is very similar in terms of its reliance on the VM generation ID GUID. So we're dealing with cloning in a virtual environment. So we need a PDC emulator, which is Windows 2012. We need the source we're going to clone to be in the clonable domain controllers list. We need to check a compatibility list to see if it's clonable. We then remove incompatible components, declare them safe. We create a cloning XML file, which tells us what the new DC should look like. We shut down our clone source, copy the VHD, and then we create a new clone DC from that VHD file. And this gives us a very, very rapid way of deploying our DCs. DCs are now ideal for virtual environments. And if you think about it, what a DC does, what does it do most of the day? Absolutely nothing, all right? It handles all that logon traffic at 9 o'clock in the morning or 8:30 in the morning or for the first couple of hours in the morning, and then it sits there doing nothing. So it's a great thing to virtualize, because what we can have is our file servers on there or something, we decide what else goes on the host virtual machine. And after it's done its work in the morning, it's just sort of sitting there consuming virtually no resources from the host. So seriously think about actually doing virtualization of DCs. And we can, as I say, we can create this cloning step. And once it's cloned, it brings it up really, really quickly. This default clone allow list, what it is, it's a list of things Microsoft have checked out and said they're clonable, right? So it's all the services that Microsoft know about. They've decided they're clonable. If you test and find that it's objecting to something, you can test that particular service yourself to see if it works when you clone it. And if it does, what you do is you actually run this little command, get ADC cloning exclude application list, generate XML, and it does it for you. And it creates an XML that accepts everything on that source machine as being okay for cloning. We've also got a cloning XML. I'll show you that in 1 second. Okay, so what I'm going to do is very, very quickly clone a DC, and I'm going to clone DC2. So if I go over to DC2 on here, and the first thing I'm going to do is just run this up. So I'm going to check out whether this particular DC is suitable for cloning. So I do a get AD DC clone exclude list. Oh, sorry. I don't know, it's completely... My switching capability has failed today. So what it's done is I've run this command, get ADDC cloning exclude application list, and it's telling me my browser's not compatible with cloning. And you think, hang on a minute, it's a Microsoft browser. Why is it not compatible? It's not compatible because I've fudged the list that is compatible. So I've actually gone and done something just purely for this demo, which is I've gone down into the down into System 32. And if we just do a default on there, default clone allow list, and I don't want to open it with that. Just open it in Notepad. And in that list is basically all the services Microsoft have tested and saying they're clonable. And in here, all I've done is I came into this list. I put an S on the end saying the browser service is clonable, but what it then means is it thinks the browser service is not clonable. So what the best thing to do is when you're creating this thing is to do a, is to actually say new, we're gonna create the XML to do the cloning. So we do a new ADDC clone configuration file. And what it will do is it goes through and verifies the prereqs. Do you remember I said the PDC emulator needs to be on 2012. So it's just done a check, and it says the PDC emulator is on a 2012 server. It says this domain controller is a member of the clonable domain controllers group, but then it's failed on the fact that we've got this incompatibility. So what I can do is do all my testing on the DC and say, okay, I'm happy that everything is clonable, and once I'm in that state, what I do is I create new ADC clone configuration file, and I actually specify here that we should be generating, sorry, that's the wrong command. I do the get the clone list, and I then do in here, generate XML. Right, we can now go and run the new ADC clone file, but what I'm going to do is actually run one that I've got up here, and if we put on WordWrap, you can see that you can specify the IP addresses, the DNS address, the new computer name, default gateway, the site it's going to go into, etc. So let's run that, and let's pop that into here. So rather than run that command, it does the checks. It's now happy because it's using the custom file. And if we look down in the NTDS settings directory, so if we get into our Windows directory, into NTDS, what we've got is the custom clone allow list, which is the one which has browser in it. Remember, browser is normally compatible, but I made it non-compatible. And then we've got the DC clone config file, which is that one I just created. So now if I copy this VHD, right, I could leave that clone file in there, or I could service the VHD offline and put a different clone file in, and then fire it up, I've got a new DC, fire up another one, got a new DC, fire up another one, I've got a new DC. It's a very, very rapid deployment of domain controllers. So when you're thinking about going to Server 2012, think, is it time to virtualize my DCs? So I would seriously think along those lines as well. Because as I say, DC is an absolute ideal vehicle to clone. And then, ideal vehicle to virtualize. And then using this technology, you can actually deploy extremely rapidly. Sorry? I mean, in terms of, the question is, do you actually need physical DCs? I mean, if you're distributed with your hosts, right? So if they're all in one data center, then, you know, if you lose the data center, you've got a problem. But if you're distributed, your DCs, it really doesn't matter that they were all virtualized. because you've got no real gain by having a non-virtualized. I mean, I know a lot of people kept physical DCs because they were scared of virtualization. But now virtualization is seen as an extremely robust platform. And I know an awful lot of companies that just every DC is virtualized. They don't keep any physicals anymore. DC's on.
I can't remember if there was also some sort of a Kerberos time issue with DC's on a hypervisor. Is that incorrect? Or anything that you're aware of?
Not. What you need to do is when you bring it up on the I know what you're talking about. So the question was about Kerberos time synchronization, and it's actually just an issue with time synchronization. What will happen is the host will try and force the time synchronization of anything you're running on it, and what you don't want that to happen. So you want your PDC emulator to act as the time source. So your PDC emulator, if you've got a root forest, would be, you know, if you've got a forest with a root in it, it would be the PDC emulator, and the root goes off and becomes authoritative for time for all the domains in the forest. And then the PDC emulator in each domain is the time source. So the PDC emulator in the root goes to an authoritative time source. It then acts as an authoritative time source to the DCs, the PDC emulators in the other domains, and that they act as time sources to all the other DCs and everybody else. Yeah, but you can have problems if you leave the integration on, which forces the host time into the guest time.
And does that still carry over?
Yeah, I mean, it's just part of the configuration. It's just something you need to do. So what happens if you revert on an unsupported hypervisor, then you are in serious trouble. You get USN, you will end up with this USN bubble that I described previously. It'll shut itself down. So it'll actually say, I'm no longer a domain controller. So if you do it, there is that quarantine protection that was introduced in 2003 SP1. Okay, so Kerberos has sort of got lots of nice little tweaks to it, and the number one, has anyone suffered from the Kerberos token explosion? This is where you have, inside the Kerberos token is all your group membership, and if the group membership gets too big, the token size gets too big. And you can actually end up with people not being able to log on because, you know, the tokens exploded. You can also end up with problems where you're using Kerberos to go into web services, so the web service won't accept a Kerberos token that big. You can end up with Kerberos tokens being too big, going through firewalls and all sorts of things. So they've done some work on that. They've increased the maximum context buffer size. So that's not going to help you with, you know, talking to web services, et cetera, because you'll still need to get the web service to accept a very large token. But what they've also introduced is pack group compression. So if you're running completely 2012, then you can actually have the pack, which holds all the group membership, compressed. But there's now warning. Previously, there was very, very little warning about you've got problems with your token size. So now you've got warnings, increased logging on Kerberos as well. But the major, major changes to Kerberos are this ability to do constrained delegation across domains and claim support. So in terms of delegation, nobody's done delegation here, but just very briefly, the idea of delegation is you come to, say, John is out there, he comes to a front-end server as John, and then we delegate his identity to a back-end server. It's very common with SharePoint, so SharePoint talking to other systems. The problem has always been that the service that runs the front-end server and the back-end server need to be in the same domain. Right? Well, now with 2012, you can have them in different domains. You can even have them in different forests. So if someone says, oh, we can't do constrained delegation because the services are in different domains, now you can. And I know a huge number of companies that is really pleased about that change. The other interesting change is that the PAC now actually holds, group membership as it did before, but it can also hold group membership for users and devices. So now I can make a decision based when I'm doing looking at access, not only about the user and the user's group membership, but the device the user is on. All right, so we can actually now control access based on the, so we can have, if a computer is in a particular group, I can say, if that user's in a group and the device is in a group, let them in. All right, so I can do that. Plus, I can add claims. And all a claim is, it's an Active Directory attribute that's been marked as a claim. All right, so we could take the office location string, mark it as a claim, and then it will be added to the Kerberos token. So we could say, you know, if device is so-and-so, if user is in the New York, you know, office, then allow access. So you end up with this very rich capability for this thing called dynamic access control. Files you can now classify, and you can tag them, and you can apply this to audit policies as well. And we've got this expression-based access control that we can use. So you can end up with something like this. And down the bottom there, what I've got is I've got the user department equals corporate sales, the user's job title equals sales manager, and the device the user's on, the department attribute of the device is corporate sales. Allow access. So you can come up with a much richer access control model. You can do auditing based on these expressions as well. And if you haven't looked at dynamic access control, it's probably worth looking at some time in the not too distant future. So you can do it for file access, but you can also do it for auditing. So expressions can contain groups, they can contain claims, users, devices, and so on. And we've got this capability of the compound ID. Now, how do we get the compound ID? What we need to do is enable Kerberos armoring. It's also referred to as FAST, which is Flexible Authentication Secure Tunneling. And when you enable that, it then can take any attributes you've marked as security attributes and convert them to claims and put them in the token. It allows the other thing that you can do with Kerberos today, you can spoof it, all right, by sending error messages saying, I can't do Kerberos, and what will happen is the Windows Negotiate will come down and start using NTLM. Now what we can do is we can secure those error messages so they're actually signed, the error messages, to sort of prevent that. Plus, when you log on for the very, very first time, when you log on, you put your credentials in, what happens is there is a timestamp in the Kerberos token that is effectively signed with a hash of your password, right, and encrypted with the hash, not inside, it's encrypted with the hash of your password. And what we can do is now we can protect that initial logon. That's part of the armoring, which then protects you against dictionary attacks. Exhaustible resources, we got DNTs in the database. Every time you add something to the database, the DNT goes up and up and up, and eventually, you know, you can add something, delete something, add something, delete it, delete it, delete it, add some more things. That DNT can get very large. And you've never been able to know what the current value of it is. Now you can actually see it. It's an attribute that is exposed called the approximate highest internal object ID. What does it mean if you exhaust the DNT? It means that domain controller can no longer have things added to its database, right? But what do? You basically just rebuild the domain controller. because at that point, because you've only got up to that value because you haven't got 2 billion objects in your AD. What's happened is you basically, over time, you've had 2 billion objects in the AD because you've added and deleted. The other one is the RID pool. The RID pool can get exhausted. And once the RID pool's exhausted, you can no longer create RIDs. Therefore, you can no longer create security principles, and your domain is dead. All right? The value of the maximum RIDs you can have is 1,073 million, which if you create 10,000 RIDs per day, your RID pool will last you 294 years. The problem is people have abused their RID pool by setting it too big. Remember I said 500? Some people have set that up to sort of 5,000, 10,000, 50,000. So every time a new set of RIDs was allocated to a DC, it just pushed it right over the top. So what's happened now is that the RID pool can now be doubled in size. So we can now break that RID pool limit. It's also got warning. It's got a ceiling at 90% usage. So when you hit 90% usage, it will actually stop you creating more security principles. And the idea of there is you have to intervene to create more principles. Right? And it's sort of saying, it's like a big error message. It's a big warning to you saying, look, do you realize you've used up 90%? And you have to intervene and say, yeah, I know I've used 90%. I'm now going to figure out why we've got so many RIDs being used. A good attack against your Active Directory is someone could manually bump the RID pool, and then you'd be in serious trouble. But now if you've got 2012, you can double the size. So you can unlock it and double its size. There's more little things. There's support for index, deferring index creation, just lots of nice little features that have been added, increased LDAP logging, and there's also Active Directory-based activation as well for our Windows 8 and our Windows 2012 machines. You still need the KMS support for down-level volume licensing, but if you've got volume licensing and you're using volume licensing, Windows 8 and 2012, we've just got this AD-based activation. So the biggest things is the ability to do the virtualization properly. Everything else is just things that absolutely needed to be done. And it sort of sets us in the right space to go for the changes that are going to happen in 2012 R2, which are very, very much towards the integration of ADFS, claims authentication, and so on. So just watch that space for the changes there. So that's I've run a couple of minutes over time, and I apologize for that. That brings us to the end of the session, and it was sort of 2012 in as short as time as could be achieved. I hope you found it useful, and of course, the last session. Enjoy the party tonight if you're staying for it. And please, can I ask you, it's very important, if you could do the feedback and evaluations, because there's actually a critical level. They don't count unless it gets over 10 people. 1, 2, 3, 4. So your evaluations are going to be very, very important. If you've got any questions, by all means, come down and ask. Otherwise, I'll let you go. Thanks for coming to the session.